Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, and this is the Friday Roundtable. We're spending the month of January examining where our criminal justice system both fails and fulfills its mission to uphold justice. You can find discussions about private prisons and why so many women are being imprisoned on my podcast. Just search NPR News with Carrie Miller on iTunes. We'll be covering plea bargaining, racial inequity, and the view of Minnesota's criminal justice system from the county attorney in the state's largest county. Today, we've invited three guests to the roundtable who bring their experience from different parts of the justice system. We'll hear from a federal judge, a public defender, and a county attorney. But I want to hear from you as well via social media. How much confidence do you have in the fairness of criminal justice in this country? Have you had an experience that either informs your confidence or concerns about it? And you can talk to me about that on Twitter. It's at Kerri, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Our roundtablers today, Chief Federal Judge John Thunheim. Judge, welcome back. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Kerri.
Maria Mitchell is with us. She's an Assistant Hennepin County Public Defender. Welcome back. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
And Pete Orput is the County Attorney for Washington County. And it's a pleasure to have you on the roundtable for the first time. I hope you'll come back.
Thank you.
We usually don't scare people off, so we'll see what happens with that, Pete. Judge, I saw a statistic as I was preparing for the show on women in prison that was really startling, and maybe it has some implications for criminal justice at large. Upwards of 80% of the women who are in federal and state incarceration, jails and prisons, are there not for a violent crime. They're there for a drug crime or a property crime. Does that match with what you understand about the federal criminal system?
It certainly does. I think that women that are incarcerated in the federal system are probably largely convicted of drug crimes. Sometimes they are associates of others who are convicted of drug crimes in conspiracies where it gathers up a whole bunch of people. And then probably the rest are embezzlement or crimes related to stealing money from an employer or something like that.
Is this the case for incarceration as a whole? I mean, are most people, men and women, incarcerated for crimes that we would not think of as violent crimes? Maria, do you know?
I don't know the specific statistics, but I believe that a lot of the people that we deal with that are incarcerated are with drugs and property crimes and drug-related crimes. Mm. So it may not be that it's addiction-related, drug-related in terms of they are addicted to something and it morphs out of control and it becomes a stabbing or it becomes a shooting. But they're all related back to the drugs and property crimes.
So does that tell you something about the criminal justice system?
It does.
What?
It tells us that we are failing on the ability to treat substance abuses and to treat them effectively and have the things available that we need to keep people out of the criminal justice system.
Pete, what does it tell you?
Well, I do agree with Maria's assessment on that. Drugs really do drive a good deal of my cases. But in Minnesota, I don't think it's quite as terrible as the narrative out there in public media. We have 9,000 offenders locked up in Minnesota in prison, and of that, less than 10% are women. So keeping that in mind, but then go to a state like Wisconsin. Demographically looks just like Minnesota. Socioeconomically it does. They'll have upwards of 28,000 in prison where we have 9. So it's almost 3 times more people incarcerated.
And what are the differences? I mean,
well,
why
that's
would there
my
be
question.
Such a difference?
Does one feel safer in Milwaukee than they do in Minneapolis? I'm not sure. I think we take a more progressive approach to using prisons here. We try to save those few beds for either the violent criminals or the recidivists, those who just can't behave themselves. And I think we do a pretty good job of sorting that out.
Judge, what would you think about that?
Well, I agree. I mean, what we really need, I think, and I think the state is experimenting more than the federal government is immediate treatment options for people rather than immediate incarceration. So many of the federal drug crimes carry a mandatory minimum or carry at least a presumption that you're going to do prison time, when I would much rather send someone to treatment right away, put them on supervised release, and see how they do. If they mess up again, go to prison at that point in time.
Do you have that ability to sentence like that or not?
I can do that unless I have a mandatory minimum that applies. And remember that mandatory minimums go to drug crimes and gun crimes. That's where they are at in the federal system. So as long as you have a crime that is not a mandatory minimum, so the drug quantity isn't that high, then we have some ability to put someone into treatment right away. If you've got a 5-year mandatory minimum, you don't have that option.
Do you get the sense that public opinion supports that idea that we should be focused more, especially when it comes to drug crimes, focused more on treatment and less on incarceration?
I think we're moving in that direction publicly. I think the numbers have come out and they've shown that this country incarcerates people at a far greater rate than other Western countries. And we're trying to move in that direction, but it's difficult to do if you don't have the infrastructure and support to do so, because the if you don't have a bed for treatment, then there are not many options if you don't feel that person is safe. I mean, you can't send them to the hospital if there's a mental illness concern that's an MICD, mental illness and chemical dependency. And the only fallback option is an incarceration, whether it's a local jail while they wait for a treatment bed or for a mental health bed, or if it's prison.
The odd thing about this is if you put the numbers up next to each other, right, it costs a lot less to invest in treatment than it does to incarcerate somebody for a certain amount of time. Why isn't that persuasive at the state legislature, at the federal government?
I might think, Carrie, that politics is involved. You know, the get tough on criminals part is an oft-heard meme. For my office, though, we work really hard on trying to separate the wheat from the chaff, the addict from the drug dealer. There's a big difference there. Drug dealers are killing our kids, especially today. Drug addicts are needing help, and I'm not convinced that putting somebody in a jail cell helps them overcome.
But is there always that bright of a line, Pete? I mean, aren't there people who are addicted who are dealing to support their addiction and whatever lifestyle?
They are, but in my view, when someone starts selling drugs, if it's to sell drugs just to feed your own monkey, that's one thing. But if you're making a profit off people's misery, then I'm going to ask that they pay me back for dealing drugs in my community. The addicts, on the other hand, they have enough problems. I'm not convinced that throwing an addict in jail is the right thing to do.
And I would say that I think it is really difficult to separate the wheat from the chaff, because I think a lot of times you don't have all of the information when you get started. I think your office does do a very good job of thinking about those issues, but I don't think that there's a uniformity of that across the counties. I also believe that it's difficult to determine, you know, what is the level of involvement? Because there's a lot of income that is unreported, and it's hard to tell who's really making a profit off of people and who's just an addict. And really, if the underlying problem is poverty in the system or in the country, and that's the way they find their way to make an income, then it's just, I don't know, it becomes a little bit circular at that point.
Judge, go ahead.
A very high percentage of the people charged with a drug crime in federal court are also selling drugs. And they are addicts that need the money, or they need the drugs to keep going. And that's where they get caught up in the system. We don't have possession crimes in federal court. They go to state court systems instead. But it's that mix of the two that you want to get someone away from drugs, and you can get them back to a productive life if you get them away from drugs. If they're going to sell drugs in order to get drugs, then they're going to get charged, and a prison term is not always the right idea there.
I was just
going
to say, when you say the idea is to get people away from drugs, maybe a prison term is only a temporary interruption in that and isn't addressing all the other stuff that contributes to that.
We have good drug treatment programs in prison, but it's still, I mean, I've started imposing a condition for when someone comes out of prison, they have an immediate assessment as to what kind of treatment they need for drug addiction so they don't go back to it. I think that sort of thing helps, but in many of these cases, I'd rather send them to the assessment and then treatment right away.
Pete?
I would too, except following up on what the judge said, our correction system here in Minnesota has pretty effective treatment. In fact, I know the Department of Corrections is doing a study on those who go through treatment and then get out of prison. And right now, the early data shows that there's some real remarkable success when you get somebody into treatment. And for some drugs like methamphetamine and heroin, I think maybe some guys do need to be put in a cage for a while before they can even get their head around facing those demons.
Maria?
Well, I think that there are some people that have, I mean, I think what makes it so complicated is the multi-diagnosis, the people that come through with the PTSD and they have the personality disorder.
So they have mental health issues and a drug addiction.
Correct. And I think that although prison offers treatment, there are many people that remain on the waiting list for those treatments. And then there needs to be that extra step of transitioning into the world. And that becomes very difficult. I mean, you can still access drugs in prison and you can still access drugs in jail. But I think that I think trying to get the treatment on the front end before we do put people in a cage, we can keep from institutionalizing them.
Which would be great. But I want to also let the listeners know that our legislature passed, I think, a landmark drug reform act, which essentially cuts the drug penalties in half for the people who are using, but it remained tough on the sellers. And I think it was a pretty good outcome, and we're waiting right now to see how it plays out because it's only been a couple of months, Carrie, but I think we all recognize that maybe we're hitting some of the nails with too big a hammer and we need to get a different hammer for a different size nail, if you will. And that was reflected in, I think, remarkable changes to our drug sentencing that just occurred.
You're listening to the Friday Roundtable. It's a roundtable in which we're discussing some of the ideas that are coming up in our series on criminal justice. We have a roundtable with guests who come at this from different areas of the criminal justice system. Maria Mitchell is with us. She's an assistant Hennepin County public defender. Chief Federal Judge John Thunheim is with us. And Pete Orput, the county attorney for Washington County. Judge, this is something that we've talked about in these conversations on air and off, and that's plea bargains. Here's another startling number out of the statistics here. 97% of federal convictions and 94% of state convictions are the result of plea bargaining. That sounds effective and it sounds fairly efficient for the system. Does it serve the individuals, the defendant, as well?
Well, it's a really interesting question because we could not run our criminal justice system in this country without guilty pleas. We simply
Why?
Don't have enough prosecutors or defense lawyers or judges to handle a system with so many crimes being charged. So you really need to have a system where someone can simply agree that they are guilty of the crime and they don't have to go through a trial in order to prove it. At the same time, I worry about whether we've gone too far, that there is a penalty for going to trial, an enhanced sentence that's so much greater than what you might get through a plea bargain, that we're somehow now affecting an individual's constitutional right to a jury trial to determine whether they're guilty or not guilty.
Because the system demands this and the incentives are there for this person to take the plea, is that what you mean?
It's the incentives, and sometimes the incentives are so strong that the trial penalty the other side gets to be so much higher than what you would get if you agreed to a guilty plea. Now, in a federal drug crime, for example, the prosecutor can agree not to enhance a sentence with prior convictions. They can agree to reduce the drug quantity that the person is charged with, which would likely reduce the mandatory minimum from a high number down to a much lower number. And you can give them an incentive for cooperating. And if they cooperate in the prosecution of other individuals, they can get a sentence that doesn't reflect the mandatory minimum. The judge is then allowed to go below the mandatory minimum. So you can take a potentially long sentence, which would be the result of a trial, and turn it into a very low sentence just through effective negotiation with the prosecutor.
Did you notice the nods here when you said that maybe we've gone? This is surprising. A county attorney and a public defender, and you agree with what the judge is saying here.
Absolutely. There is a concern about whether or not clients are taking deals just to avoid the consequence. On the smaller cases where there's a lot of collateral consequences, like a fifth degree assault, a misdemeanor, or something like that, you may take the plea bargain just to keep the assault off your record so that you can become employable in the future.
What's wrong with that?
What's wrong is that it doesn't put the state to their burden in terms of proving the case and allowing for people who should not have been charged to be exonerated of those charges. It becomes, you know, we got a conviction out of it. And that's not true for everyone, but it also makes the person disenfranchised from the system.
How so?
If I have to plead guilty and I know I'm not guilty, but going to trial means I have to take a whole week off of work and be on standby, or if I'm a victim, if going to trial and following through with the complaint means that I have to come in and take days off of work and relive my trauma, it becomes a real problem.
Carrie, my problem right now is, there are a lot of plea bargains, although I kind of resent that. It looks like we're doing a let's make a deal game, and that's not what it's about. If, as a prosecutor, I could overcharge cases, I've seen it done in my career. I come from the school of focus on the victim, focus on how are we going to restore that victim. Sometimes it means to show the victim that there is swift and certain punishment. But my problem for the perpetrator, my problem, though, is for those few cases where the defendant does demand a trial, the backlog is unbelievable in my county. Say, for instance, today, Monday, it's trial day. I have four prosecutors in my office all set with a case to go to trial, but only one judge. And that was the same last week, the week before, and it seems like the balloon's getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And victims aren't getting that justice that they want to know is going to happen if they go through our criminal justice system. And I find myself apologizing every week. Sorry, we couldn't get your case to trial. And that's had a lot of effects on us. I've had victims die before trial. So plea bargaining is necessary, but also trials are necessary too.
But Pete, I don't want to miss what you said about the implication of this is that you're overcharging. Well, that is what it looks like if 94% of state convictions are ending up in a plea bargain. It does look like that first entry into the system is an overcharge if you're willing to bargain down.
Well, I didn't necessarily say bargain down. I said bargain. I don't view it that way. I think we charge the behavior that we think we can prove beyond a reasonable doubt. We start there. Then the defendant comes and says, you're right, I am guilty, but here's what was going on in my life. This is what caused it. This is what I'm willing to do to restore the victim whole. And we're open to having that dialogue with their defense attorneys.
Is that usually how it goes, Maria?
I think you see both. I think you see what Pete is talking about in terms of taking into account the defendant's side of the story from two. They may say, well, yes, I'm guilty of this, but not guilty of all of these other things. And so for that part, or yes, I did this, but I was in a psychotic episode, or without going into the mental illness defense, or I was high on drugs and I'm in treatment now. And so we're going to give you some benefit from that. But then there's the other side of it too, is I just don't want to go to prison. I didn't do this, but they're offering me probation. And so I think you see both ends of the spectrum. And sometimes, we're as defense counsel, we're not supposed to say you go to trial or you don't go to trial. It's the client's decision, and they're weighing these risks. And sometimes you feel bad that they don't take their case to trial, but you know that if you tell them to go to trial and they lose, that's forever on you. But I think you see both sides.
So, Judge, what's the judge's role in that, in truly understanding what the defendant is saying in a plea bargain?
Well, a plea bargain in my court is an effort on my part to figure out whether this person is truly guilty of this crime. And I ask a lot of questions. It takes quite a while. I'm watching that defendant very carefully. I'm looking for evidence that they're not telling the truth, for example, or if they look at their lawyer for every answer. I mean, there's all kinds of things going on there. But I want to make sure that the person is guilty. I don't think there is a great deal of overcharging going on in Minnesota, either in federal court or in state court. But I do think there is considerable willingness to let someone enter a guilty plea to a lesser charge in order to avoid the preparing for and going through a lengthy trial that you may not have the resources for, or you may not have a judge to handle.
But are you saying an inappropriate amount of willingness to let people do that, or?
I don't know that it's inappropriate. I understand the resource limitations, and if you're going to go through a two-week trial and you can avoid it by a lesser charge and still get some prison time, I think a lot of prosecutors are willing to do that. And they take into account, as Pete says, the circumstances in a person's life, which I think is important for a prosecutor to take into account.
Well, another thing that I see in other counties is people can put in what's called an Alford plea. It's named after a Supreme Court case, Alford versus North Carolina. And what that is I just want to resolve these charges against me, but I'm not willing to admit I did the act. My office refuses to engage in Alford pleas. If the perpetrator doesn't want to own what they did, then I'll bring a jury in and see if the jury thinks that person did it. But I don't want to be in a position where somebody says, I didn't do it, but for all these other reasons, I'm going to plead guilty. I think that's unacceptable.
But aren't there lawyers probably going to say, you can't go into court and say, I didn't do it, but I'm pleading anyway?
There is a fair amount of that.
Isn't that where people will say that?
Yeah. Where you talk to...
In court?
No, but when you talk to your client, you say, okay, I know you're telling me that you didn't do this. Now, if you want to accept this plea negotiation, then you have to say these certain things. And if you don't, they will not accept the plea negotiation. So you either have to say it or they won't accept it. And so if you don't want to say it, then let's go to trial and you risk going to prison.
This might be an exaggeration, but it is kind of a wink, wink, right? We all may know what's happening here. And if we want to grease your skids through the criminal justice system, this is how it's going to have to play. I know that sounds cynical, but is there some of that?
Well, prosecutors are the world's biggest cynics, Gary, but no, I don't. I think to start with, it's very important for victims to have acknowledged that they've been ripped off in whatever form it is. And when somebody comes in and says, I just want to get this behind me, but I don't have the courage to admit I did this act, and typically those are horrific child abuse, rapes, things like that, then I'll have a trial because it's that important to the victim that they be believed in front of a jury or through a guilty plea.
Here's federal judge Jed Rakoff. Okay. Mm-hmm. In the New York Review of Books on a piece called Why Innocent People Plead Guilty. You might be familiar with it. And he says in this essay, our criminal justice system is almost exclusively a system of plea bargaining negotiated behind closed doors and with no judicial oversight. The outcome is very largely determined by the prosecutor alone. Is that true?
In the federal system, judges are not allowed to participate in plea negotiations. It's different in the state system, although I'm not sure to what extent judges participate. But in federal court, you can't. You're specifically prohibited by rule. So the prosecutor and defense lawyer and the defendant come in with a deal, and they present it to the judge, and it's up to the judge to make sure that it's fair and it also is accurate and it's voluntary.
And you can say no, right,
can say
to the
no.
deal as
Absolutely.
The judge.
Absolutely. We can say no if there's something that is amiss as part of the, say, the person really doesn't admit to the elements of the crime or dispute something. I'm not going to accept the guilty plea then because it's not a valid conviction.
Do you have the level of concern that Judge Rakoff apparently does on this?
Well, Judge Rakoff and I were confirmed together. He's a good friend, and he's worked very hard over the years to bring an intense focus to this question. And I do have some level of agreement there because these are not open court negotiations. These are behind doors negotiations, and we want to make sure that they're accurate and they're fair in the end. But at the same time, you know, it's a hour long hearing. How can we be absolutely sure if the defendant is calm and says all the right things, whether they're really, truly guilty of that crime?
Maria?
I think it's difficult because, again, it goes back to that, the penalties. If the penalty that you're facing is so significant that you feel like you have to take a deal in order to, I guess, to preserve whatever you can out of the situation or to move on with your life, then I think a lot of defendants are comfortable going in and entering the plea. You hear a lot, I want to get it over with. Sometimes it's because they don't want to accept responsibility. I mean, that might be the reason, too. They'd say, well, I'm innocent, but I'm going to plead guilty anyway, and they know they're guilty. But there are other times when, you know, they are trying to cut their losses. They have children that they want to be in their lives. They have all these different obligations and situations that would be devastated if they were to be locked up.
What would really be helpful for this issue, Carrie, is if we worked as a criminal justice system to reduce what I call the trial penalty, the penalty that is enhanced because you go to trial. You don't get acceptance of responsibility. You might not get the benefit of any kind of reduced charge that the prosecutor might agree to. And so you get the prison term. You get the longer sentence that you wouldn't get by entering a guilty plea. And if that trial penalty isn't too far apart, it's not a bad thing. If it gets really far apart, a long, long sentence by going to trial and a relatively short sentence by entering a guilty plea, that's where we start running into these issues that concern us.
Is that sentencing reform, or what is that? I mean, how would you make that happen, where the gap is not so wide between the two?
Sentencing reform would help. If we didn't have mandatory minimum sentences that tie the hands of judges, you can have a closer tie between a lesser trial penalty, essentially. That would help. You know, prosecutors' policies make a big difference here as well. I think every office develops policies about what they're willing to do, and some are better than others.
Pete, how do you handle that, this idea of the trial penalty?
My anecdotal experience would say that's very true, that if you push a case in federal court to trial, boy, you better go for broke because the penalty is going to be great. Not so much in state court where we have Minnesota sentencing guidelines. So everything's within the guidelines, whether you go to trial or not, generally speaking. And I do appreciate that some judges get so upset when someone wants a trial that they may be a little harsher on them. But that's part of the job of the prosecutor. We're ministers of justice. I say that so often because people think that my job is just to collect scalps off people who unfortunately do stupid things in our community. And that's not it. It's all about safety. It's all about respecting victims and giving them access to justice as much as it is the perpetrator.
So if you regard yourself and other prosecutors as ministers of justice, it must be very frustrating to see, I think we're going to hear about this on Twitter, the level of confidence that many parts of our community hold the criminal justice system in, and a lot of the evidence that shows that there isn't a lot of equity in the criminal justice system.
I can tell you, if your listeners could see me, they'd see I look like I haven't slept in months, because I haven't, because this stuff does keep me up at night. But I think the vast majority of the prosecutors I know worry about those things, worry about the public perception of the criminal justice system, worry about the fairness of it. It is a great deal of power that they've given me, Carrie, and it's enough to keep me scared every day. Scared that I want to do the right thing and I don't want to get bamboozled. At the same time, I have a strong commitment to protect people who've been ripped off.
So, Maria, do you think most of the defendants that you work with view the prosecutor's office as ministers of justice?
I would say no. And I think there is a twofold problem there. I think that the criminal justice system is now addressing the issue of mass incarceration. And so I think that a lot of the heads of prosecutorial agencies are starting to look at that and figure out how they're going to implement it. But it's juxtaposed against some of the younger prosecutors with less life experience. And then there's also the idea that racism is a big issue in our country. And so there's a lot of distrust of the institutions that have come out disproportionately against communities of color, especially Hispanics and African Americans. And so you have all of those different things that contribute to the lack of confidence.
Judge, what would you say?
It's a good question, and it's a very difficult one because there's so many potential issues that come into play. I mean, I think judges try very hard to make sure it's a fair system that treats ethnic minorities, racial minorities in the same way as everyone else. But you have built-in issues that are tough to get around. You know, prior crimes that count and enhance your sentence. Sometimes that disproportionately affects certain communities, and it's hard to get around those because that's the way the system is built. I do think we all need to look very carefully at these issues and make sure we do what we can to try to treat everyone in the same way, and it's a difficult thing.
Maria, is that part of the challenge, what Judge Thunheim is saying about the built-in? I mean, it's hard to just rewind a lot of the built-in realities for as much reform as we're interested in doing, right?
Absolutely, because it is a societal problem. I mean, if we start at the very root of it, the different things that have happened with poverty and about disproportionate policies and the concentrated areas of policing, I mean, it all works together. The funding of schools, the housing, it you can't separate it out. And so the criminal justice system is just a reflection of other failed policies, in my opinion.
Well, my biggest problem is I think what we've just been talking about is true, and I'm terribly sensitive to it. For those minorities coming into the criminal justice system, when they literally come through the door, they don't see a lot of people that look like them. And that's been an issue that's been driving me crazy my entire career. I think it's important that the prosecutors look like the people in their communities. And they are the people in their communities. And I think that's how you build trust. My problem, however, is when I try to hire people that I think would be perfect, some really top-notch candidates, I'm competing with the private sector, which pays three times what I do. So it's kind of a hard sell for me to get prosecutors from the community doing the work of a prosecutor so it reflects the community. And it's an ongoing struggle.
You're listening to the Friday Roundtable. It's a roundtable about criminal justice, and we're talking about a lot of the issues that we're raising in the series focused on criminal justice throughout the month of January here on the show. Federal Judge John Thunheim with us in the studio, Maria Mitchell from Hennepin County Defender's Office, and Pete Orput, the county attorney for Washington County. We'll get a look at the latest news, and then we'll continue our conversation.
Good morning. I'm Phil Picardi for Minnesota Public Radio News. Just a week before his inauguration, Donald Trump is proclaiming his defeated rival, Hillary Clinton, is, quote, guilty as hell and should not have been allowed to run for president. In his tweets this morning, Trump appeared to be responding to a Justice Department probe of how the FBI handled its investigation of Clinton's private email server. It might not be the most sought-after job in Mexico as the Trump administration takes office, but Mexico's president has chosen his new ambassador to Washington. Jeronimo Gutierrez Fernandez is currently head of the North American Development Bank, which was created under the North American Free Trade Agreement. Donald Trump has said he wants to renegotiate that agreement. The U.S. House is expected to vote today on a measure to make it easier for any future bill repealing the health care law to advance without the threat of a filibuster from Senate Democrats. The legislation does not need to be signed by the president. Its passage is crucial if Republicans controlling Congress are to keep their longstanding promise to kill Obama's signature health care reform. The Justice Department today releases a report on the Chicago Police Department after a year-long civil rights investigation. The probe was launched following the release of a 2015 video showing a white police officer fatally shooting black teen Laquan McDonald. And Oklahoma highway officials are warning motorists a winter storm moving into the southern plains is creating slick spots on roads and bridges. Freezing rain was reported before sunup in a band from southwestern Oklahoma into southern parts of Kansas and Missouri. Forecasters warn the areas could see significant accumulations of ice before the storm moves to the east. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:41.
Increase the impact of your sustaining membership by switching to an automatic deduction through your checking account. It eliminates credit card fees so more of your gift can power the radio you love. Switch today at npr.org/checking.
Support for this program comes from John Reamer & Associates, a private wealth advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc. in New Brighton with more than 25 years of experience. Putting more within reach at johnreamer.com.
I'm Carrie Miller, and you're listening to the Friday Roundtable. It's a roundtable with guests who come to this discussion from different parts of the criminal justice system, and we're tackling a number of the issues that we will be talking about throughout the month of January on the show. Pete Orput with us, county attorney for Washington County, Maria Mitchell, assistant Hennepin County public defender, and chief federal judge John Thunheim. I want to talk about bail, Maria, and I'll start with you. There's been a lot of attention on the inequity of bail. The numbers, again, are really concerning, the statistics here. More than 60% of the people who are in jail in this country have not been to trial, and many of them are only in jail because they don't have the resources to post bond. So they're doing time, even though they're presumed innocent at that point in the system. Why, and what might be some of the – let me start out with why, and then we'll talk about maybe some of the reforms around that.
One of the first things that comes to mind is when you're talking about pleading guilty to avoid the consequences of trial. There are people who plead guilty to avoid the consequences of being in jail as well. Mm-hmm. And that becomes a problem because they can't make bail, but they know that it's a probationary sentence and that they won't do any additional time. So it's kind of like, if you plead guilty, then we'll give you credit time served and you'll be on probation for that period of time. That's one of the issues with bail. Another issue surrounding bail is, what is a appropriate amount of bail? In Hennepin County, we've done a good job of trying to educate judges, either the public defender's office or other criminal justice institutions have educated judges about bail reform. $50 is a lot of bail to a lot of people. In misdemeanor cases, they've started to set them at $78, which is the surcharge that is mandatory according to the court system. But even at $78, some people remain in jail. With respect to higher level crimes, that's where it gets a lot more sensitive in terms of being able to access bail money. For felonies, if it's the $1,000, it becomes $100 to a bail bondsman, which is 10%, and you don't get it back. And so a lot of times we'll ask for cash alternatives and that. But bail continues to be a problem. There's been some community initiatives in New York, and they're trying to start that here, where there's a community fund for bail so that when you get arrested, you can draw from this community pot to bail you out, and then it goes back in when you show up for court.
Got it. You know, Pete, I want to make sure that I understand what the idea of bail is supposed to be. From your standpoint, what is bail for?
Two reasons. One, I need to make sure that person comes back to be held to account for
what
they
did. And the incentive of the money will bring them back.
Well, if they put a little money into it, they're pretty reluctant to take off on me. But the other one, and the one I put most emphasis on, is public safety. I get a guy that kills his wife or a neighbor, I need to get a couple of $1 million bail, and that's really because I can't let this guy out. Now, that means he's going to have to sit in jail and wait until I can gather the evidence and try the case. But letting him out isn't an option.
But that's a pretty unusual case,
well,
isn't it? Aren't most of the people that are posting bail for not in a situation like that, struggling to come up with a couple $1,000s for the fifth degree assault that they've been arrested for, or whatever? Tell me what it usually looks like.
Well, let's just look at it. Let's just say I get arrested, and I'm arrested for a DWI,
uh-huh.
A common occurrence, 40,000 people a year get it. I get put in jail, and a judge wants to make sure I'm not going to skedaddle on him. But more important, a judge wants to make sure that if he releases me, I don't go out drinking again before this trial. So they ask for some money, sometimes $10,000 bail, sometimes no bail. Frequently, we agree to release people on condition that they make a promise to come. But the more severe the case, the more I want to assure the public that this person isn't going to be out reoffending or taken off on us. So it's kind of the bigger little test. If it's a big crime, we need big bail. If it's a little crime, little or no bail.
But little bail, I think, Maria, you were saying, can be pretty big or impossible.
And I think one of the things is that there's not a lot of consistency across counties here in Minnesota. I think your bail may be very low in one county and might be high in another, and it could be the exact same offense. You might have a prosecutor who's agreeing to no bail required because there's no criminal history, no prior fails to appear. And then in another county, it may be $10,000 bail. And there's not a lot of consistency there. But what is consistent is that a lot of the defendants have no financial resources. And so that becomes, I think there's a problem in that in and of itself.
Again, the federal system is different here because there's no right to bail in federal court like there is in the state of Minnesota. You see sometimes someone charged with a terrible crime in the state and bail is set at $10 million or some outrageous figure just to make sure that they probably can't make that bail and they have to stay in jail pending the charges. In federal court, we either decide you're jailed because you're a threat to the community or a threat to flee, or you're released, and we have pretrial services officers who supervise them to make sure that they stay away from criminal activity during that release. I think there's an interesting question in federal court is whether we jail too many people pretrial and maybe jail too many people that adversely impact minority communities, for example. And that's something we're always looking at to try to make sure we're doing this fairly because it is very difficult to sit at the facility in Sherburne County and with a lawyer who is probably 45 minutes away or an hour away, and it's tough to get a chance to talk to your lawyer and help the lawyer prepare for trial. I mean, it's just impact on the family of jailing someone before trial. These are people who are not convicted yet, and we have to be very careful to make sure that they really are a threat to the community or a threat to flee. Otherwise, they should have a right to work with their lawyer, to be out in the community, get their affairs in order if they're going to plead guilty, and you know, have a right to participate in the criminal justice system in a way that's very difficult to if you're stuck in a jail 45 minutes away.
How much flexibility does a federal judge have in that? I mean, if you wanted to see fewer people, as, you know, spending this amount of time in jail before they even have even been tried, could you make some changes to that?
We have considerable flexibility in whether you jail someone pretrial or not in the federal system.
Pete?
There's some other innovative things that my county's been working on, my community corrections folks who do the pretrial release, like the judge said, where somebody gets released without bail. But we don't want them to just go out in a community. They might not behave themselves. We've now come to a pilot using GPS. So if I put a GPS bracelet on somebody and tell them you cannot go back to your spouse or whoever you're stalking or any of that kind of behavior, mm-hmm. we'll know exactly where they are. That gives us the assurance in most of those cases that we need. I need to protect the public. I can do it with a GPS. And that's now in the pilot stage. I'm guessing a couple of years from now, and the prices go down, we'll be using that far more frequently.
Does that seem more fair, Maria, or do you have concerns about that, something like that?
I think that actually does seem more fair because it meets the concern of the public safety, because a lot of these people, it's, you cannot predict public safety. So there's going to be a certain amount of risk that a judge has to take. And I would say that there are times when I've had clients in state court that have a higher bail than what they have in federal court. For some reason, there hasn't been there's not a connect between how to determine public safety versus the ability to, be on your own recognizances. And I think that that would also impact people who are in poverty who can't afford the bail because they'd be able to get out. There are obviously privacy concerns associated with not being convicted but monitored, but we much rather would be out in the community than in a jail cell waiting for trial.
I want to make sure I understand what you just said, though. You said there is no way to connect between the idea of public safety with being out on your own recognizance.
It's very difficult because we've had a case in Hennepin County where there was somebody with a domestic assault charge, their first assault. They go out and they kill their wife. And there's no indicator for that. On the other hand, you might have somebody who has several convictions, but they're always the same conviction. They're filing an order restraining order by texting someone or by having contact by telephone, but they would never ever rise to the level of killing their spouse. And I think even though these are indicators, it's very difficult at the end of the day to assess whether or not this person is a true danger to
society. And that is the judge, right?
Right.
Making that assessment.
The probation office is a great help in this. I mean, they have scoring mechanisms that look at the past history and try to predict whether someone would either reoffend during the pretrial period or might abscond. And it's very helpful, and it's fairly accurate. I mean, I would much rather let someone out, let them participate in trial preparation or perhaps plea negotiations, give them conditions, and if they mess up seriously, then we'll put them in jail. But let's give them a chance, and I would much rather do that. And most of our bail is unsecured, so no one really has to put money into it. I mean, if they abscond, they can...
You mean for the federal system?
For the federal system, okay. Yeah.
And yeah. That's why they may be out on bail in the federal system, and then they might have a high bail in the state system because they have that unsecured bond.
I think the judge said it. It's about finding a way to assuage ourselves that the knucklehead in front of us doesn't go out and do something awful. And I've had a number of those cases. They convince a judge to release them. They go right back out and commit the same crime again with somebody else. So finding the sweet spot, if you will, between holding them to account to come to trial and not misbehave, at the same time, they do nobody any good sitting in a jail cell. That costs a good deal, upwards of $100 a day to keep somebody in a jail. So just from a conservative point of view, jail isn't the number one thing to reach for. What's to reach for is how do I get assurance that I don't agree to release a guy and have him go out and do something else? And that's what we struggle with.
You're listening to a Friday roundtable on criminal justice, and I hope you're thinking about this and you can weigh in via social media. How much confidence do you have in the fairness, the equity of the criminal justice system in the country, in Minnesota, in our region, and in the country? And have you had an experience that either informs your confidence or your concerns about that? So you can tweet me at Kerri, KerriMPR. Judge, I want to ask you about something that you put in the email when we were setting this up, which is that President Obama, gave clemency to one of your defendants, and you were happy about that.
I was.
Will you tell us a little bit about the case?
Well, the case had a long mandatory minimum where I was stuck. It was a 10-year mandatory minimum and a 5-year enhanced mandatory minimum above that, a consecutive sentence because a firearm was discovered in association with a drug crime. It was too long. The sentence, I think I said at the time I sentenced this individual that this sentence is too long.
Really?
But I can't do anything different. This is the crime that you're charged with. It carries a mandatory minimum. It carries a consecutive add-on, even though it wasn't really clear the firearm was being used, but it was present, so that was enough. And I thought it should have been half that sentence, and so he still has served, I think, over 10 years, so it's still been a long sentence. But at the same time, I thought that was a fair use of the clemency power that the president has. This person will be let out next summer so that there's some time to prepare for a release into the community. And I was really happy about it. It was a good use of the clemency power.
Now, President Obama has done a lot of that. Are you all comfortable with the way the president has used his powers of clemency? Because I think they amount to, what, more than all of the other presidents, like in the last 7 or 8 terms combined? That might not be right, so we'll check my facts on that. But are you comfortable with the way President Obama has used this, Maria?
I'm happy with it. I think it reflects the times and the literature that's come out about the problem that we have with incarceration in this country. It's over-incarceration if we're comparing it to other Western countries, and it's good that we're looking at cases individually and that he's allowing some relief regarding that.
Pete, what do you think it represents to see how the president has used this?
I think if I were the president, I'd do the exact same thing. I'd take my values and apply them to some of the offenders that are currently in our federal prisons, and I'd ask myself, is this a fair outcome? And I think if you dig deep enough, you'll find anecdotes that just wouldn't appear fair under all our values. And
you but mean I, that these people are serving too long of sentences?
Yeah,
okay.
Sometimes. At the same time, I look at it and I say, we did start incarcerating more offenders maybe 20, 25 years ago. And as we did, the crime rate plummeted. And that I struggle with because, you know, we're all sharing anecdotes and we're trying to make policy based on anecdotes. But when you look at the data carefully and you see that the crime rate is going down as the prison rate is going up, that suggests some correlations. Maybe we're locking up the right knuckleheads that need to get off the street.
I thought we all pretty much agreed, though, that too many, at the beginning of the conversation, that too many people are incarcerated, and a lot of them are serving too long of sentences.
I think that's a fair assessment. I couldn't conceivably argue against that when you have 2.2 million people in prison, which is a significant share of our population relative to other places. But I do want to just point out, though, the more that people went to prison, the more the crime rate plummeted. I don't know if that's just, you know, chance or if there's some correlations we could draw. But in the case of what Judge Tunheim was talking about, I really appreciate that His Honor is the one that has to make that final decision. I really do. I've many, many times sat in court going, what would I do if I were the judge? Mm-hmm. I think one would find that I have a softer heart than I do when I'm advocating. But I look to the judgment of someone like His Honor because he doesn't have the same, necessarily the same pressure points I'm under.
A last thought on this, Judge?
Well, I think the president's use of the clemency power is a reflection in part of the harsh sentences that have come out of the war on drugs. They haven't been changed yet. The mandatory minimums, there was supposedly a deal in Congress to reduce them, perhaps a deal to eliminate some of them. Nothing happened in the end of this last Congress, so now maybe it'll come back in the new Congress again. It's interesting to look at in the question about whether mandatory minimum sentences really worked at all. I mean, they work in the sense of perhaps warehousing people that might commit other crimes, but are we doing that person any good? Are we doing society any good? That's a really tough question to answer, and I think the president has done the right thing with his clemency power.
And Maria, one last thought on this?
I would just take issue with the fact that it actually was reducing crime. The National Academy of Sciences came out with a report in 2014 which said that it's basically a minimal decrease in crime. And so I think we're going to have to continue to think about decreasing sentences and being more effective at rehabilitation.
Let me just say this, that my sharp producer there, Marquita, informs me that President Obama has used clemency more often than any other president since President Johnson. Pete, you wanted one last word on this.
I tip my hat to the president for doing the right thing, which I assume that's what he is doing. I think there are some very legitimate concerns. When you look at sentencing across the board, if I have, say, 20 grams of cocaine in my pocket, I can do more prison time than if I came up and committed an aggravated robbery, put a gun to somebody's head, and took their wallet. That, to me, doesn't seem quite right. So I have to concede that, especially in federal court, some of these sentences are so beyond draconian that it doesn't seem to make sense.
Thank you all for a really good discussion.